This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
So I am a professor of psychology and neuroscience, which places me in a distinct minority in this room. I'm going to talk to you today about my neuroscience research on the social influences on emotional learning and decision making. And I'm going to leave it to you to speculate a little bit more about how that might have implications for law or not. But I'd like to, you know, encourage that in the discussion. So I want to just talk a little bit about how we study the human brain and try to understand emotion in the human brain. And one of the things that we know is we now have these great techniques for studying the human brain, primarily functional human imaging. But this technique is limited in a lot of ways. And so to the extent that we can take the behaviors we're interested in and link them to other techniques, we can get more information about what's going on in the brain and the neural systems that might be involved. And I've been interested in this perspective in my laboratory. So in trying to understand emotion in the brain, I've started with what we know from non-humans, particularly rats. And I take those paradigms that you can conduct in rats and as much as possible try to extend them to humans in a sort of a direct way as possible. And so one of the things you do in rats, if you want to understand how we learn things, how we learn that something's emotional or not emotional, is you might take simple stimuli, such as a blue square or a tone, and you might then pair it with something emotional, such as a shock or some food. And this is essentially how rats will learn things that predict, things that lead to rewards and punishments. We can do very similar things in humans in the laboratory. We can take things like blue squares and pair them with shocks, and we can take tones and pair them with rewards like money. It's always complicated knowing how to reward humans in the laboratory. But ultimately, we're really interested in not so much in, you know, how do you learn about blue squares and tones, but how do you learn about the things that matter to us, particularly other people? And then how does this then relate to what you might, the choices you might make in a social context? And of course, that's what the law is. It's a social context where we have to make a lot of choices. So we have taken advantage of this approach to look at how we learn things that create fear responses and how we learn things that create reward responses and how this then may be altered when you're dealing with another individual. I'm going to give you two examples of this research today. First, I'm going to look at how your learning about whether somebody's particularly dangerous may vary by the race of that individual. And also, when you're learning about how to respond to the feedback that someone might give you a reward will vary by your knowledge of their moral character. And I'm going to do this in a way where I sort of take advantage of what we know from the models from non-human animals and then extrapolate to humans. So let's start with fear. The primary paradigm that we use to look at fear learning is this paradigm of fear conditioning, essentially Pavlovian conditioning. Where this is an example with a rat. I borrowed this slide from Joe Ledoux, who's a collaborator of mine, where the rat hears a tone. Tone is paired with shock. And then the rat comes to elicit to a range of fear responses to the tone itself, such as increases in freezing, blood pressure, heart rate, respiration, stress hormone release. We can do something very similar with humans. Take something like a blue square, pair it with a shock, and then humans will elicit a range of fear responses to the blue square itself, such as the one I'm going to talk about is sweating, an increase in skin conductance, which is a measure of autonomic nervous system arousal. And we know from lots and lots of research in rats and more recently in humans that the amygdala, which is here in red, is a critical brain structure in the acquisition, storage, and expression of this type of learning. And in humans, we've shown this. So here we show activation of the amygdala. Well, now I have the blue square that's paired with shock versus a yellow square that's not. Here I look at a patient with amygdala damage. So this is the skin conductance response to the shock itself. Patients with amygdala damage show these normal autonomic nervous system arousal responses. What they don't show is the one that's predicting a possible shock to the blue square, and a normal control subject will. So, you know, this may not be surprising, but like other animals and these very simple types of learning paradigms, The amygdala is necessary for this physical expression of a learned fear response. This is the woman whose data I just presented to you in sort of cartoon version. She has she suffers from bilateral damage to the amygdala. So I'm going to play for you what she said. We showed her her data, and we asked her to comment on her data. So I'm going to play for you what she said. And hopefully, the sound will work.
I notice if there's anything odd about my reactions to normal lifestyle, life threats, my fear element seems to be, to me, in my head, normal. I've never noticed anything odd.
And how do you feel seeing this result? How
I'm dead. I think that it's probably absolutely correct. I know I don't sweat. I knew that there was an anticipation that the blue square was going to, at some particular point in time, bring on one of the bold shots. But even though I knew that, and I knew that from the very beginning, except for the very first one where I was surprised, I really don't think that I knew it was going to happen, but that was my response. I knew it was going to happen. I accepted that it was going to happen. So I learned from the very beginning it's going to happen. Blue shock happened. I turned out to be right. It happened.
So I think she somewhat dramatically demonstrates, even though she fails to show me in this sort of implicit physiological way that this stimulus predicts she might get a shock, she can certainly tell us in a very explicit way what the emotional nature of that stimulus is, at least in terms of, you know, the danger to her. And this type of dissociation between an implicit evaluation of something that we can measure, say, with physiology, and this explicit evaluation of something that you tell me by your your declarative knowledge, was reminiscent of some research my colleague at Yale was doing at the time. This is, we were both at Yale at the time. We've both left since then. Mazur Banaji on looking at bias in looking at social bias and race bias in particular. And so social psychologists, see, now I'm trying to have this really nice new Mac, but it's very complicated. social psychologists have suggested there's two types of attitudes. And they actually talk about them as having fairly different representations. And their explicit attitudes, they're those that we consciously, explicitly express. So attitudes are really an evaluation of something, right? And implicit attitudes are expressed through our actions without our conscious effort or control. And this is just my favorite example of an implicit attitude. I don't know if you guys know this report. All the women in the audience are shaking their head. But you know, for years and years, a women scientist at MIT came and said, you know, why is my lab space smaller than my colleague? How come I don't get paid the same as my colleague? And every example that came up, the dean would say, well, you know, your colleague had that paper in Science, but you only published in Neuron or something like this. Or, you know, your colleague got this grant, and then you got this other grant. And somehow, you know, every decision was justified. But MIT, being the good science institution that it is, eventually did what they should do, which is a study. And they found that there was this persistent pattern of gender discrimination. And so they wrote, to their credit, I don't think this would happen at NYU, they actually wrote a report on it and published it. And you know, indicated that in every instance they thought this was unconscious and unknowing. As much as, you know, you may think this is a cop-out, I actually think it's fairly brave, because I do believe that's some of the way these biases get expressed.
What was the differential by percentage?
Oh, I don't remember.
Was it a 2% effect or a 50%?
I think it was somewhere between those two.
I feel assured, yes.
You know, if you sit in enough of these meetings where you're justifying why people do things, you completely believe this. In any case, so we had this idea that maybe, given that this was reminiscent, this dissociation between this sort of implicit way you express your evaluation of a blue square versus what you tell me. This was a dissociation was reminiscent of what we see in these two types of attitudes. So that led us to the idea that perhaps, you know, we could see evidence that the amygdala was related to sort of one type of expression of this bias, but not the other. So to look at this, we did an experiment where these were white American subjects. They were Yale undergraduates. They were presented black and white unfamiliar male faces. During the scanning session, they weren't actually told the study had anything to do with race. It was a simple memory repeat identification study. Afterwards, they were given implicit and explicit measures of race bias. There were two implicit measures. One of them was startle eye blink. This is a physiological measure of consistent with a fear response. So if I were to go like this, somebody in the room should have startled. Maybe that wasn't loud enough. But if you hear a loud noise, one of the things you do is startle. It's a natural reflex. If you hear a loud noise when you're walking down the street late at night and you're already a little nervous, you startle a little more. So startle is a reflex that's modulated by your emotional state. If you're anxious, you startle more. The other was the implicit association test. Does everybody know what that is? Anybody not know what that is? Okay, so I'll go over it. This is a test that's been used quite a bit by my colleague, Mazrin Banaji, and collaborator. And essentially, it's a cognitive conflict task. So the way this test works, I won't make you take the test. This is a demonstration form of it. The way this test works is you see a series of stimuli appear one at a time, and you're asked to press a button on the left if it's a black face, in this case, for this version of the IT, or a word that means something bad, as quickly as possible. And a button on the right if, you know, the stimulus that comes up is a white face or a word that means something good. You do that for about half the trials, and then you you can read the slides, very good. Sorry. So you have to press the button on the left if it's a white face or a word that means something bad, on the right if it's a black face or a word that means something good. And most white Americans will take longer for this pairing than the opposite. And our white American subjects were no different than the average white group of white Americans. And here's their differential reaction time for the two different pairings. And here's their startle eye blink. So they also startled more when they were just looking at the black face as opposed to looking at the white face. We then asked the question, well, how does this relate to activity we see in the amygdala? And I'm going to show you two versions of this. Our measure of explicit race bias was the modern racism scale. And what we see is a significant correlation between bias as measured by the IAT and the amount of amygdala activation these subjects showed when viewing a black face versus viewing a white face. Same thing with the difference in the eye blink startle, no relation with the score on the modern racism scale. And here's just another way of plotting this. Here we said, show us regions of the brain where activation to the black versus white face is correlated with these different measures, and the amygdala emerged in both of these, but not when we did that with the modern racism.
Did you do this on black people?
We didn't do this on black people. I'll tell you why we didn't, but other people have. We didn't do it because if you look at the IIT, we found it, if you look at the IIT scores, it's actually much more variable for black subjects. And at Yale, the Yale undergraduates don't show a pro-black bias on the average. They look a little bit more like not very biased white people on that IIT. So we tried actually to do inner city New Haven participants, but they were so unfamiliar with the medical school environment and sitting still on scanners and stuff like that that it was just a little awkward. So there's another group that actually did something with black subjects and showed an opposite pattern. They didn't actually look at the correlation with the IIT. So this suggested to us that, you know, these unfamiliar outgroup race faces result in amygdala activation. So here's the other study by Hart, and this is for both black and white Americans. But it varies quite a bit, and it seems to be related to implicit measures of bias. And I should point out, we also did a test of people that were highly familiar and well-liked and found no such correlation at all. So since this study, there's been other evidence that these effects can be modified by different types of things. So this led us, this association between the amygdala and the other race, viewing other race faces, led us to think about, well, what could that mean actually when you are interacting with somebody of another race? And so we know the amygdala, as I mentioned earlier, is a part of the brain that's very important in learning to associate something with something negative, also positive, but I'm not going to talk about that today, right here. And so we thought, well, maybe the amygdala, this sort of amygdala response we see to other race faces, is that somehow biased learning, future learning about these individuals. We asked the question, how might this amygdala response, oops, what am I doing here? Okay. So fear conditioning is really classical conditioning, right? It's classical Pavlovian conditioning. And Pavlov argued that there's this sort of equal potentiality of stimuli. So anything can be paired with anything else, and I can get this response. That's not true. We know that's not true. There are exceptions to this. You drink a margarita, and you get sick 4 hours later. You know, it's not the toilet bowl you're afraid of. It's the margarita, right? Certain things go together. Another example of this is this notion of prepared fear of learning. So it's been argued that through evolution, there are these natural classes of stimuli that show an enhanced and more persistent fear learning when they're used as a conditioned stimulus, as the neutral stimulus in this type of paradigm. And this has been shown, the argument for evolutionary preparedness is probably strongest in monkeys who will show this type of prepared fear learning to, say, a toy snake, even though they've never been exposed to one before. And so we ask the question, and I should just also point out, we know from prepared stimuli, the amygdala response is, you see a greater amygdala response that is actually more robust when faces are when the stimuli are presented subliminally, so sort of unaware of them. We also see that same effect when looking at other race faces. So we wanted to ask the question, would other race faces look like prepared stimuli? The argument, the evolutionary argument here is these things were natural threats through evolution. So now if you have one bad experience, you're going to hold on to that fear a little longer. So this is the classic type of stimuli that would be used in these prepared and unprepared fear learning studies. These would be the prepared stimuli, these are the unprepared stimuli. So what we did is we did a fear conditioning study. Subjects saw one of these stimuli and got a shock. The other one was our baseline. They got shocked to one of these stimuli. The other one was our baseline. And here what I've plotted is the difference in the skin conductance response, this measure of arousal that you get, to the stimulus paired with shock and versus subtracting out the one that wasn't. So this is anything above zero is a significant effect. Here's where I'm pairing the stimulus with the shock. And here's when I stop pairing it. And when you stop pairing it, especially in humans, you get a fairly rapid, pretty quickly they get the knowledge if you pair it 100% of the time. You stop pairing it pretty quickly, they learn, now I'm not going to get the shock anymore. So we see slightly greater acquisition of the fear for the fear-relevant stimuli, but it's also harder to get rid of the fear when you've learned that things are different. We did the exact same experiment. With black and white faces. Stop. So again, one of these was paired with shock, the other was our baseline. One was paired with shock, the other was our baseline. And we saw a very similar result. So here, these outgroup race faces look like prepared stimuli in fear conditioning. You have a slightly higher fear response to the outgroup race face, and it's harder to get rid of that fear once it's acquired, once you have new information so saying this is no longer dangerous. This was true. Now we had a good cohort here of white and black subjects, and this was true of both groups. And if you looked at these data, you might say, well, the black subjects show a slightly smaller effect. But then we said, well, what are the, we looked at a number of variables to see, what might moderate this effect. And we found that one variable significantly moderated this effect, and that was whether or not you dated somebody of another race. So if we take out all the subjects who dated outside their race, which was about half of our black subjects, and about 25% of our white subjects, we saw roughly equivalent magnitudes of effects in the two groups. So this, suggests to us that there may be this preparedness to fear dissimilar others. And that, we don't really know why. You could argue it's due to some sort of physical similarity, or perhaps your cultural definition of what your group is. We favor this last explanation. Let me just tell you why. If you buy this evolutionary argument that the reason our fear learning systems are biased to have us acquire stronger fear responses to some stimuli because they're natural threats to us, through evolution. If you buy that argument, if we think about evolution, we actually didn't evolve in multiracial groups. We have multiracial groups because different human lineages separated. But we did evolve in social groups. And it's certainly the case that somebody who's not part of your social group may be more of a natural threat to you than somebody who is part of your social group through evolution. So we think that perhaps how your culture defines what your group is what may be mediating this effect. We don't know if this is you know, for sure or not, but and that intergroup contact, particularly something like dating, you know, may really moderate your definition of what your in-group is. And I should point out, you know, we have a lot of other measures for contacts. They're all sort of correlated. This was the only one that reached significance. So I don't want to say it has to be dating. We don't really know. But this tells us, you know, that this gives us some idea that, you know, our ability to update these negative impressions we have about other individuals. And here, of course, you know, we're extrapolating a lot from these skin conductance responses, but nevertheless, it's one form of how we might evaluate somebody else. Based on new information that this person now is no longer dangerous to you, may differ depending on their race group status. And we, again, think it's more your sort of your prominent definition of what your in-group is in this case. So I want to move on now to the second part of my talk and talk about another sort of learning system in the brain and talk about what we know about it and particularly how we think social factors might influence that learning system. So I want to talk about reward learning, and you already heard a little bit about this already. And when we talk about reward learning in the brain, we often talk about this region here, which is this in green here, which is the striatum, which is really a collection of regions that all of which seem to play some role in reward learning. And different regions of striatum, and I'm just, you know, I don't expect you to interpret all this, but this is a study done in rats. Different regions of the striatum respond to different parts of reward. And so here's the response of dopamine neurons in different regions of the striatum. Here's cocaine being administered to rats, the dopamine response that they get. And what I want to focus on here is this right here. So I'm going to talk about the dorsal striatum. Here's this sort of ventral striatum part, which I'm not going to talk about so much. It seems to be important in predicting reward. This dorsal striatum here seems to be important in actions linked to reward. So here's where we get into decision making. You know, you have an action now that's linked to reward. And so I'm going to talk more about this region here. But this is this is something we know from rats, and then we're, again, extrapolating from humans as to what's going on. In this reward system, one of the things we know, it's a rather indiscriminate reward system. Lots of brain imaging studies have been done, and it doesn't seem to matter what the reward is. So I just gave you an example of cocaine. People have done cocaine in humans, and they see activation of this region much like you would expect based on the work in rats. But, you know, we also see activation of this region in response to money rewards, juice or food if you're hungry or thirsty or hungry, cooperation, beauty, praise. So this reward system seems to be rather indiscriminate in what it responds to. We're going to talk about money just because it's easier to manipulate in the laboratory than things like food in the scanner. It doesn't really work. One of the things we know about this dorsal striatum, you know, it seems to be involved in sort of goal-directed behaviors, and particularly learning about goal-directed behaviors. So this is a study we did, which is mirroring studies done in rats, where now I'm giving you a card, and I'm going to say this card, you know, you see this card, and it tells you whether you should guess high or low for this number coming up. So they have a number between 1 and 10. They have to guess if it's going to be above 5 or below 5. They're right, they win money. Okay. So the card tells you a certain percentage of time that, you know, the right guess is below or above. And so you're just basically learning probabilities here. So this is just an example of the 100% condition. So this is what we see when you win versus lose money in this region. Now we had a bunch of conditions. I'm not showing them all to you. But early on, 100% condition, people learn pretty quickly. When I see the circle, guess high, I'm always going to win. When they're learning that, we see a big response in this region when they win. But after a while, once they've known that, they know exactly what to do, this response in this region when they're going to win goes away. And that's because we think this region here is using feedback to guide your future actions. But once you know what the correct action is, you no longer need that feedback. Okay, so once you've actually learned the correct thing to do, the feedback becomes unnecessary. That reward signal that tells you how to change your future behavior goes away. This is not just when you have, you know, dots and or circles and squares that tell you to guess high or low. It's also true when you're interacting with somebody else. So here's a study that was the trust game, which you heard a lot about, and I'll give you another little example in a second. This was done by Brooks Keith Casas and Reed Montague's lab. And they actually had two people playing the trust game, interacting. And one of them was at Baylor College of Medicine, where Reed is, and one of them was at Caltech, where Colin Kammer, their collaborator, is. And they did a number of rounds interacting with this one partner. And what they found was responses in this particular region of the striatum, caudate, once they sort of played a couple rounds with the individual, when now you won money from that individual, your response was diminished because you knew their reputation. Okay, so you're learning a reputation with somebody because you're interacting with them. You're finding out if this person's likely to reward you, they're not likely to reward you, what's their pattern. Once you've learned that pattern, you don't need this signal anymore to help you guide your future actions, and this reward response diminishes. So again, this reward response we think is important in using reward feedback to guide future actions. How am I doing?
You are done at 3:40, so you have 20 minutes.
I have 20 minutes?
No.
The whole thing?
Oh,
my whole talk was like 20 minutes. Okay, fine. I'm good for this. Never mind. That's okay.
I'm just going to finish my talk. So
trial and error, learning by trial and error, as we've already talked about, is not the only way to learn whether somebody has a good reputation and you can trust them. There's other types of learning. One of the things is I can tell you, you know, if you know somebody's a good guy or a bad guy, you judge them, you know, in this regard. You can also decide now whether or not you want to trust them. And so we wanted to ask this question, does this learning about social and moral character influence the brain systems of trial and error learning? And this is a study we did in collaboration with Bob Frank. And it was a trust game, and all the trials were identical. So the subject in this case was always the person who was deciding whether to share or keep, and always the investor, the first mover. So if you were a subject, you got a dollar, you had a choice. You could either keep the dollar, in which case it's yours, you take it home. Or you can share the dollar with your partner, in which case it gets magnified to $3. And the partner has a choice. They can either keep the $3, or they can share the winnings with you, and then you each get $1.50. The subjects played this game with three different partners. Now, Bob is a wonderful writer, as you all know, I'm sure. He wrote these little vignettes, so you know they had a little story about each of the partners. They were all graduate students. This guy here, his name's Chris. He was an English graduate student. Prior to going to graduate school, he worked for Teach for America for a year. They all had a news story about them. So this guy here, remember that fire in Rhode Island at the club, right? So he was there that night, and his friend's wife got left in the club somehow, realized she was missing, so he went back in to get her, and he got burns in the process. So he's a hero, you know, and he also worked for Teach for America, and he's doing humanities, so he's a good guy, right? He's our good partner. This guy, Alex, Alex is getting his MBA at UNLV. Okay, Bob wrote this, not me. you know, and if you remember, like, when the Space Shuttle Columbia exploded, NASA, like, you know, put out the call, these finding pieces, that we need them for our investigation. Well, this guy figured, well, you know, they probably have enough. I'm just going to try to make a little profit here and sell them on eBay. So he's our bad guy. This guy, Tom, you know, Tom's an engineering student. There's this flight that crashed, and Tom was almost on that flight, but he got stuck in traffic, and he actually missed the flight, and so, you know, he had this really arousing thing happen to him, but of course he had nothing to do with it, and so he's our neutral guy. And so they played, the subjects played 24 rounds of the trust game with each one of these partners. The partners were equally likely to share or keep. They each did 50-50 reinforcement. So in this game, again, you had your decision, you saw the person, you had your decision, you had your outcome. Three different outcomes, you kept it, or they decided to share and give you the money. So prior to scanning, we asked them how trustworthy do you think this person is. We also asked some other questions like, is this person likely to recycle, things like that. And so ahead of time, they thought that the good guy was more trustworthy than the bad guy, and the neutral guy was in the middle. Afterwards, They reported everybody's equally trustworthy, and they could also tell us, they knew, they could report to us that 50% of the time, you know, they all shared and kept the same amount of time. They still thought the good guy was more likely to recycle. But if we look to how often do they choose to share with their partner, they shared more with the good guy than the bad guy, the neutral ground in the middle. But ironically, in spite of the fact that they could tell you that they were more equally likely to get rewarded, even at the very end, they continued to share more with the good guy. So when we looked at the brain, so here we've compared all the trials where the partner shared or kept, so you either got a reward of $1.50 or you lost a dollar. And here I've plotted responses in this region. These take some time, we can talk about that in a second, but we see what we would expect to see. An increased response when you get a reward, a slight decrease in response when you now lost some money. But for the good guy, we didn't see any modulation in this region at all between getting a reward or not. And here I've just plotted this for you in another way. So this told us that this knowledge about moral character somehow diminishes this reliance on trial and error feedback when you're making choices. So even though this guy is doing the same thing, you aren't either updating your choices, and you're not using this brain system that essentially uses that type of information to help you guide future actions.
Even if you did update, you still have a difference between the original data is valid. It's kind of like a Bayesian calculation, which would take both things into account, so only one.
Yeah, I mean, but the point, yes. So the point I'm trying to make here is that, you know, we aren't using this, not only are we not, I mean, it would make some sense, right, that you would, that you might bias your decisions based on this gut, right? But nevertheless, you have perfect information, and you still don't use that information. I mean, they say he's not trustworthy, so now maybe they're just saying they like him more or something, who knows? But we don't use these brain systems that are actually incorporating that information in the same way. All right. So, you know, what I've suggested to you, just to wrap up, you know, in fear learning, there may be this preparedness to fear dissimilar others, and in reward learning, this knowledge of the moral character impacts our reliance on these feedback mechanisms, and we actually may be less dependent on actual data in making our choices. And that both of these suggest that, you know, our ability to incorporate new information in our responses and our choices varies by who we're interacting with. And the question is, does that anything to do with law? Well, that's a question for you. When we start to look at law and neuroscience, you know, what the advantage we have is we know something about all these different factors in the brain. We can bring in legal theories and try to understand a little bit more about how they influence the decisions we make. I would argue that we want to diminish biased legal decisions. We need to be aware of how these natural social biases, which may not be something that we're consciously, explicitly, you know, trying to apply or not apply, will bias our decisions and how we might want to be able to counteract those biases. And I put this in here because Monica suggested I should talk about this, and I won't have time, but if you have a question, you know, my other area of research is emotion and memory, and, you know, we can also understand how emotion and feeling memory will help us evaluate memory in a legal system setting, which I'll answer a question if you want. Thank you.
That I've had for a long time about the implicit bias study, so I'm sorry to plague you with it, but you're
That's
here.
Okay.
So, suppose you think that you live in a society in which African Americans have systematically less opportunity and worse life chances than whites, then it's going to be very natural and automatic that you'll associate that face or whatever with the idea of unhappiness. And that, then to know whether that indicates any bias against African Americans, we'll need to interpret that further, to know whether you think that unhappiness is a good thing or a bad thing. But certainly the fact that you notice the unhappiness just means you're realistic. You're noticing what's in fact true. When you get the family of words connected with anger, well, once again, pairing African American with anger might mean many, many things. It might mean I'm angry at the way they're being treated. It might mean they're rightly angry at the way they're being treated. It also might mean they're bad, angry people, and I'm afraid. You know, so once again, without knowing a lot more about the reasons behind the association, we really can't tell whether the person's biased or just, you know, pro-African American. So I don't really feel, I've never taken the test, but I know too much about it now to do it, I guess. But I guess I don't feel
you should take it just to you know, see what it does.
We would learn about bias from maybe pairing African American with nasty, unkind, or some, you know, word where you can't, it seems to me, interpret it any other way, but that there being some sort of a bias. But the unhappiness family and the anger family seem to me not to indicate very much in and of themselves without further interpretation.
Well, I wouldn't have characterized those words as, you know, unhappiness. I mean, there's a whole range of words that just mean something bad. I mean, really, it's bad.
Well, there are some words that just do mean unhappy.
But, you know, there has been, you know, literally over a million people who've taken different variations of the IIT with all sorts of different pairings of, you know, words and concepts. And it does vary depending on what concepts you're using. But you're absolutely right. I mean, what you want is actually not to say that, you know, this is a cognitive conflict. And a cognitive conflict and a reaction time measure can be, you know, measuring all sorts of things. And you can't just by that one measure know exactly what you're getting. You would like to be able to now apply these to, you know, to show the relationship between these types of measures and real-world behaviors. And there have been quite a few studies of that. Some of them, you know, you guys won't care about. They're things like how close do you sit next to somebody, you know, that kind of thing. But there was recently a nice study that came out looking at the decisions that doctors make in treating people that come to emergency rooms who are black or white, that show that the correlation between IIT and a suggestion for sort of more intervention in trying to treat patients with potential heart, you know, problems. And so that's the kind of study you need to do.
Yeah,
really,
and the ones about the resumes when people apply for jobs seem to be much more
clear. Right, and so, you know, and those are the kinds of studies that need to be done to really show that these biases apply. Mazarin Banaji has been doing some studies looking at undergraduates and giving them sort of mock jury things where she's actually taking the videos from court TV. And having them, you know, make the sort of, you know how those things go. I mean, I've only watched them in that context. Maybe you guys watch that show more, but you know, they set up the whole trial and what happened, the little drama. And you know, she's shown some relationship, at least in terms of undergraduates, in terms of the bias scores and choices that would be made. So you're absolutely right. You can't say what's one thing or another thing on the IIT alone. And that's a problem with the reaction time measure always. It's not a specific measure. Now I think the potentially startle data, and that was, you know, your concerns are really one of the reasons why I wanted to make that sure that got into that paper. Potentially startle data, I mean, we know that's an affective response. You know, that is something, that's a reflex that you have, that you can't consciously control. It's an affective response. It's not about unhappiness. And it's a defense response. It's a typical defense response. Yeah?
Two things. In terms of implicit bias, it's Justin Wolfer's studies of MBA officials that you might want to look at.
Yeah.
That's massive statistical and thing. I was actually curious about the apparent, the good, the bad, and the ugly, sort of neutral, that...
You're all ugly, I think.
there apparently was not any learning. I would have thought, or suspected, that in terms of retribution, with the good player, because there was randomness, there would be a sense of disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was violating the norms that one would expect, given expectations, that there would be all the more change and more retribution, in a sense. And it doesn't occur. Why not?
I can tell you why I think it doesn't occur in terms of the memory systems. But I should just say that when we did this study, our intuitions were exactly the same. So what we actually thought would happen was the social information would sort of weigh the reward signal and the punishment signal, right, in a way. So we didn't see an exaggerated punishment response when the good guy, you know, cheated you.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we thought would happen.
Right.
That's not what happened. What I think it is, and we're now doing experiments to follow up on this, we know from just the learning and memory and brain literature that When you do this sort of trial and error learning, the striatum is a region that's very important in trial error learning. You do something, you get feedback, do something, or kind of habit learning in a way. The hippocampus is a region that's important. If I tell you something and you can recite the rule to me and then apply that rule in a very clear way, that hippocampus is important in that. And we know, this is work of Russ Poldrack, that these two memory systems actually sometimes compete with each other. So if you're applying a rule, you're not using this sort of learning on feedback system. If you're learning on feedback, you see less activation in this sort of, you know, now I've got this explicit knowledge, I'm going to apply in this very explicit way. So So we actually think that's what's going on here. We're using a different kind of memory system to drive the choice, a different kind of learning, where we've now learned, we've kind of learned the rule, and we're just deciding to apply that rule based on this guide, which is why the behavior doesn't update as much. So we think it's really a competition of memory systems, that using that other type of knowledge has taken this system offline. And we know this just from the habit learning literature. If you learn a habit, but you do it because you're now applying a rule versus paying attention to the feedback, you're going to have a different memory system. So that's what we think. I mean, I could be wrong about that. We're trying to do experiments and follow along.
I'm curious, you do black and white experiments. Mm-hmm. You try to generalize by going to other racial groups in the United States, for example, doing sort of Southeast Europe Asians mm-hmm. in populations, white populations, or doing two of those groups against each other. Mm-hmm. And if so, do you find the same in-group-out-group kind of stuff that you find in this? Because if you found differential situations in the black-white arrangements apart from the others, then you've got to have an explanation. But if they're sort of the same across the groups, then it doesn't suggest any differential bias. In this situation, it just means in groups are always more familiar. They make greater discriminations amongst people of their own kind than they do with the outsiders. And the basic evolutionary theory would be, well, with a stranger, we know he's more likely to kill me than to trade with me. So once I know what his color is, I don't have to worry about anything else. I just want to get out of there. But with somebody who's of my own race, where I have a higher percentage of voluntary intuitions, not only do I have more familiarity with what he looks like, mm-hmm. but also I have a greater gains from discrimination because he may not be an enemy, he may be a persuader. So the evolutionary theory would say you expect to see those differences, okay. but it doesn't suggest that it would be a function of white-black, it would just be in-out. And I'm so curious as to whether or not you've actually tried to run this thing with Hispanic against Asians and see what would happen.
So, I mean, there's lots of research, lots of this bias research has been done with a number of different groups. So, for instance, Koreans and Japanese will show strong biases towards each other in the Bliss Association test. We haven't done a lot of this, but the one little bit I can tell you about is that fear learning study. So, the way we do this study, we don't put out this ad like, we need black and white subjects, right? We put out, we need subjects. So we run everybody that comes in the door, doesn't matter what their race is, and then we break them apart. So we had a small group of Asian subjects. And we didn't publish this data. But what was interesting to us, I mean, if you do an IIT, the Asian Americans actually look more like the white Americans. On this test, they actually looked, on this test, they looked more like the black Americans. And if you think about why, you would imagine what is the most prominent outgroup to you if you're in this culture and you're Asian. It's probably white Americans. And white Americans are the most prominent outgroup for everybody except for white Americans. And so we think that it sort of is, there is a weighing of out-group status, in a way, in that particular finding. But, IIT results don't show necessarily the same type of pairings. That may be more about cultural learning, about the actual qualities of different groups. And we haven't done any of the startle measures or things like that. So, yeah.
You've shown us that the reward system becomes pretty flat once you are accustomed to a stimulus, mm-hmm. a positive
stimulus. At least that part of it, that's the part about using feedback to guide actions, yes.
Okay. This sounds a bit like what we read from the happiness literature, that if you get the good stuff for a while, you no longer find it interesting, yeah. and your reaction is flat. Is there more than a spurious correlation between the two? And if so, could these two findings from two literatures teach us that in policymaking, we really should look at happiness / this kind of reward reaction, because this is meant for us to be something different. It's meant to guide our choices in environments that change. Mm-hmm. It's not meant to say us anything about welfare.
Well, I can't. It's hard for me to extrapolate to that literature based on this finding. I can tell you that and Kevin mentioned this briefly, one of the interesting things that's emerging from this, from looking at brain signals in the striatum is how flexible they are based on the current context. So if it's not about whether you get $4. It's about whether you get $4 where one is the norm, versus you get $4 where 40 is the norm. It completely moves around depending on the current context, the reward signal that you see. And there's a number of studies now showing that, and it's very interesting because it kind of gives a lot of validity to this notion that that how we interpret the value of something is very dependent on our current state. So that's the only thing data here that I think is probably, I think it's most relevant to what you're talking about. I'll let you extrapolate more.
Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of addressing the implicit bias, and I think I've heard you say before that we can't necessarily extrapolate anything from that in terms of actual
prejudice. Until we link it to things that we would call, you know, that we would have all agreed upon, we would call prejudice.
Right. And so, for example, I'm sure you've seen, I think we've talked about Sam Summer studies and some of mm-hmm. PBL's work studies. Yeah. So, for example, a jury that has at least one black member, even if he or she does not participate, actually can change the decisional process and make it more empathetic toward a black defendant. So my question is, there's something here, if it's implicit, that has to do with triggering and making one aware of it and giving one a chance to address that. To what extent, and this might just make it to Richard's question, to what extent is that connected then to our desire to think of ourselves as not prejudiced and to correct for that, and therefore to what extent wouldn't it extrapolate in situations where we don't see our differential reactions as prejudiced? So we don't want to think of ourselves as racially biased, but if it were some other group that we don't have this cultural norm about, mm-hmm. perhaps it wouldn't be effective of counteracting it would work differently.
That's hard for me to, I'm still a little confused what is the exact point you're trying to get at.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is and maybe this isn't your point, maybe this is our point, of how can we as a legal system try to correct for implicit bias? Yeah. I assume that explicit bias is going to pose different issues because their people are more comfortable with their own bias.
I think that's a huge question, and this is something that, in the law and neuroscience network that we'll talk about, we'd like to get funding for. First, we'd like to show that these types of measures actually correlate with these types of issues.
Right.
Which we don't necessarily have good data on for the legal decision making.
Right.
Secondly, then you have to say how do you counteract it? And that really is the big question. There's the types of things that are being done. So for bias in general, contact, seems to, and we'll see correlations between the amount of other race contact and IQ measures. And it's not, I should say, it's not just exposure, it's actually interaction.
And then there's a number of things. So for instance, just letting somebody be aware of the fact that these exist will actually change some of the things.
Part of the problem, of course, is most people, they're like, yeah, maybe that happens for some people. It never happens for me. But as a woman in science, I now worry. Am I saying intelligent enough, soon enough in the letter of recommendation I'm writing for women? I'm not immune to these things because I grew up in this culture too, right? So, to me, as somebody who's aware of these things, and, at least in the science world, impacted by them, I have to be super vigilant. There's no difference between being part of the group, that seems to be the group is biased against and the expression of these types of behaviors, usually. So, awareness, as far as we know, is one of the things that can be done. Assuming you're going to, have an audience that's receptive to it. Most people aren't going to be receptive to that fact that their decision making could be biased in their mind. One thing I didn't mention, which I think is just interesting in this context, getting to the notion that we all have this right, this good intention. So people vary in how much they show things like these implicit biases. Jennifer Eberhardt has done these really lovely studies where she's arguing, if you have a sort of implicit bias, whether or not you are consciously aware of it, you may have some sort of, it might be some sort of sense of an interaction where if you don't want to be biased, you may be monitoring yourself a little bit more, perhaps to do some discomfort, who knows. And this takes cognitive resources. So she actually does these studies where she has people interact with somebody of another race group, and then she does a classic Stroop paradigm, where essentially you see a word, you see words in different colors. Your job is to ignore the words and say the name of the colors. And if the word is a color like blue, but it's in red ink, it takes you longer to say red than if it was the word chair in red ink. And so this is a classic cognitive conflict test. She shows that if you interact with somebody of another race, you actually then perform worse on those cognitive conflict tests right afterwards, and that the amount of which you perform worse is correlated with your IIT scores. And so the argument she's trying to make is, we may be trying to sort of consciously monitor ourselves a little bit more and perhaps using our cognitive resources in those interactions that we have, which then, of course, leads to those resources being less available to do other types of tasks.
It slows things down.
I mean, that particular study slows things down. That again also is, these are the parameters in the laboratory. We haven't linked them to choice. And this is where I think neuroeconomics is coming in, is providing us the paradigms to now think about these in sort of a social decision-making, these basic findings in the perhaps a social decision-making framework, you know, because we've been doing these, you know, these reaction time measures and these skin conductance things and these conflict tasks and not linking them to choices per se, which is, of course, what you guys probably care most about.
We're out of time. Yeah. Can I just ask one quick question? Mm-hmm. It applies to Kevin and you as well. You use the trust game, which I'm unfamiliar with, but the one thing that I keep on thinking is, are you really measuring trust or are you measuring decisions made under uncertainty? And the innate individual differences of need for certainty, which there's a scale in the social psychology literature that measures that.
I have a relatively easy answer to that. A different study by Jim Cox that decomposed the trust game exactly along those lines, sort of what I also showed you with the Coase field and experience. You have people play against the trust, the reciprocity distribution, and see if it changes the trust. And what Jim found was that you still get significant amounts of trust and reciprocity once you even control for the uncertainty.
So you can go
very
back.
That's right.
Thank you so much.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.